This is Bill McClure for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and welcome to another edition of Take My Arm.
This is Richard Dunnigan. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is developed with the assistance of print and visually impaired volunteers.
And this is Bob Martin. All right, everyone, class is in session.
Looks like Bob's been reading again.
Remember what happened the last time?
He went around reciting Run, Spot, Run for a week.
Shows what a little education can do for you.
Well, I'll have you know that I have an awful lot of a little education. So pay attention, guys. This is important.
All right, Bob. What do you have now?
Back in the mid-7th century in Ireland, there were highways connecting the various kingdoms with the High King and Tara. By law, each kingdom had to maintain its own roads. One of these roads was called the Blind Man's Highway.
And why was that?
Because it was so well maintained that it was thought that even a blind man could travel along it unassisted. Now, how about that?
Now that is interesting.
And I suppose that as you travel down the road, you might come across the blind man begging.
I don't think so. I wasn't alive back then.
I think what Richard means is that what if someone who happened to be traveling down that road were to meet someone like me?
Were you alive back then? Richard, I didn't think Bill's that old. Do you? Anyway, if I happened to be alive back then and was walking down that road and met Bill, he wouldn't be begging.
Why not?
Because in the Celtic society, the tribe was the main social structure, and they believed that each tribe saw to the upkeep of any of their members who were handicapped.
So they weren't reduced to begging?
Right. Many of them might join a local monastery where they worked alongside the other brothers doing all sorts of tasks, but they were taken care of.
Sounds like quite a culture.
And there's more. The Celtic society at that time considered women to be of equal importance with men so that there was nothing that they couldn't do.
You mean they became lawyers and tribal leaders and such?
One woman even became king.
With equal pay?
They could even ask and tell. Also, they had a system of justice that relied upon rehabilitation rather than punishment as a means of correcting social problems.
Where did you learn all of this?
From a Celtic scholar who wrote under the name of Peter Tremaine. He wrote historical mysteries with 7th century Celtic society as a background. And in one book, he told a very interesting story.
I'm glad you're interested, Bob. But we do have programs to put on.
Well, that's why I brought up the highway.
Okay, so what happened on the highway?
I don't know. What was interesting happened in one of the villages. There was a young man who was blind and dumb, and yet there was an old woman who could communicate with him.
How did she do that?
Well, let me show you, Bill. Give me your hand. Now, tell me what you feel.
You made a line down my palm, and then two short lines to the left of the first line.
And now?
The straight line again, and then one short line to the right.
And once more?
The straight line, and now diagonal lines across the main line. What is this?
A little look at the ancient language called Ogham, from the Druidic times.
It feels a little like a tree.
Great! Because it's called the tree alphabet. And if we just went by the sounds of the letters, then we might have something like this. Give me your hand again. Tak. Ma. Rum.
Tak. Ma. Rum.
What do you think of that, Bill? From early in Celtic history, take my arm.
You know something? This sounds a lot like what happened over 1,000 years later with Helen Keller.
Wow, you're right. Maybe we could ask Dr. Bill about that.
Good idea. But while we're bringing him into the studio, we had a chance to visit recently with another sight-impaired person, Sharon Benton, who works for Wake County.
Our guest today is Sharon Benton. She is a senior customer service representative in the utility billing department with the city of Raleigh. Sharon, welcome to Take My Arm.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell us a little about yourself.
I was a student at the Governor Moorhead School. I attended there from kindergarten through the 12th grade. And from that point, I met my husband, James, and he and I married in 1977. And we both worked together to raise our family. We have a son, James Jr., who is going to be 32 in August, and our daughter, Sharon Renee, who just turned 30 in April. So we worked to raise both of our children and began our careers kind of late in life, as it were. It's rather difficult as a visually impaired person to get a job right in your teens and be able to work all the way through that time. So it took a little bit of time to get our first jobs, but we were able to achieve work in our late 30s or early 40s working for hotel reservations. So that's where I began. Now I'm a customer service representative with the city of Raleigh.
We'll get back to that in a minute. Tell me about your education at the Governor Moorhead School. Did you function as a Braille student or as a print student?
Well, actually, when I first started at Governor Moorhead, I came from the public school system in California, and I had gone to the first grade there. But when I came to North Carolina, they started me over in the kindergarten so that I'd be able to learn Braille. And so I read Braille from the time I was in kindergarten until I was in third grade. And then I transferred over to large print.
Did you continue reading Braille for any reason after you started reading large print?
Not in general, but I can remember how to do it even now.
Do you prefer reading print to reading Braille?
Yes, I do prefer print, but I always consider it a preparation type tool to have, you know, because you never know what might happen.
Tell us about your visual acuity.
With correct Chun, my vision right now is at 2200 in the left eye and 2400 in the right. So needless to say, I use the left for everything.
Does that mean your left eye gets tired a lot more than your right eye?
Actually, yes, it does.
Now, that might appear to some people to be a dumb question, but from a person who's always been totally blind, I really didn't know the answer to that, so I decided to ask. Was there much transition time in switching from the job you had with Sheridan to the job that you have with City of Raleigh?
Well, actually, when I left Sheridan, the reservation office here in Raleigh had closed, and I worked with them until the very day they closed the door. They offered us an opportunity to either move to Salt Lake City or to Austin, Texas, and James and I had just bought a home. We didn't think that it was a good idea to get involved with trying to sell our home and move someplace else. So once I left that job, I went to work temporarily at two other locations. One was for PricewaterhouseCoopers, and I worked as a survey representative to ensure that the customers who called in to the representatives there gave good customer service. You know, they had good customer service when they called in. I did that for about a year, and then I worked for another year with the North Carolina Child Support Office. And that was quite challenging because that was at that time when they were having a lot of threats. People were concerned that they weren't getting their child support on time, and they were, you know, doing bomb threats and things like that. So that was a very interesting time. I did that for about a year as well. From there, I moved to the city of Raleigh, where that was more of a permanent position.
Okay. How long have you worked for the city of Raleigh?
I've been with them now for 10 years.
Do you mind sharing with our audience how you got that job?
Well, actually, there was a contact made between the city of Raleigh and Division of Services for the Blind. The city of Raleigh wanted to expand their employment opportunities to the visually impaired in some way. A gentleman named Jerry Mundy, who used to be in charge of the revenue department, recommended to the director of the utility billing department that he consult with me. It led to an interview, and the gentleman, Chuck Smith, offered me the job the very day I went in for the interview.
Bill, if you don't mind, I have a question I'd like to ask Sharon. Could you tell us a little bit about what your job with the city entails?
Sure. One of the things that I do a lot of is assist customers in establishing a water account. They have to provide their lease and two forms of ID because they've already called and spoken with the representative over the phone who needed to have more information in order to set up the account. Anytime a customer comes in that has that information provided, they usually have to be billed for services that have already been used because they didn't sign up for their water account. Perhaps they moved here from another city or state where water services were included in the rent, or maybe the electric and the water were all on the same bill. A lot of them aren't aware that they have to actually have a water account. Another thing that I help with is when they have a leak, either if the city's meter is leaking or if the customer has a leak on the property, usually something that's not going back down into the sewer system, like the toilets flushing or sinks dripping and things like that. Most of the time, we're able to adjust their bill up to 2 times for that leak. That's one of the things that I do. We just answer basic questions and try to help them understand their billing process, educate them on the use of water and how water is calculated on their bill. Sometimes takes a little bit of time. Sometimes they stand there for about an hour listening, trying to understand. But that's our job, to take all the time that's necessary.
How is your work impacted by your limited vision?
Well, luckily, with computers, software, and everything, a lot of the information that we do can be magnified. For example, I have to verify leases for customers when they're moving into a new address. So a lot of times what I do is I scan the lease into the computer, and then I can magnify it so I can read the exact date that the customer moved in. And the leases are very tiny print, so the average person even has trouble with that. So it's a big step to be able to do that.
Do you use Zoom Text?
No, I have in the past, but with our software, it kind of hinders the ability to move fast in searching the screen for information.
Do you see well enough to use a mouse?
Yes. Our software depends on the mouse, actually.
Is there a way that it could be adapted for someone who is totally blind?
I believe that it can be eventually. Right now we're in the middle of a changeover to our new system, but I do believe that in the future it will be very much accessible.
Sharon, do you find that people react differently to you when they find that you have a visual impairment?
Well, actually, they do react in a different way once they find that I have a visual impairment. And sometimes some customers are even afraid that if they come and speak with me, I won't be able to help them simply because I don't see very well. My coworker basically kind of helps to settle that down a little bit. I have a lady that works with me, and she and I are real good friends, and she understands everything real well. But she always says, well, you know, she's actually the supervisor because she's the one that's going to be able to help you. And so that usually will settle them down a little bit, and they're not as nervous, and especially when they find that I have actually helped them.
And what about on a personal level?
There are times that it is quite difficult to make people understand that I do have a vision impairment. Again, it's one of those things, they just don't know what you can or cannot see. Sometimes people will point and expect me to follow their finger to wherever they're telling me to go. And I have to say, well, you know, unfortunately, I don't see where you're pointing. Could you please show me? There are challenges, but, you know, we do make it through.
What would you say was your biggest challenge?
Well, I would just say that probably one of the biggest challenges that I experienced was actually in the job-seeking field. It's very difficult to explain to a person just what you can or cannot see. A blind person can say, well, I can't see this. I rely on Braille. A sighted person can see everything. But if you're in the middle, that person has more of a challenge. I'm one of those in the middle. I can see some, but I can't see everything. So that was the biggest challenge, and that was the part I had to demonstrate the most. But once I had the opportunity, then I was able to show my employer what I could do.
Sharon, we've talked to James about his exploits as a bowler. Do you share that interest with him?
Yes, I certainly do. I haven't bowled quite as long as he has because during the first years of our bowling league, I had to still raise small children. But once I got them up to a good age, I also joined the bowling league, and I'm now the American Blind Bowlers Association National Tournament Committee Chair. So I'm responsible now for planning the tournaments that we go to on a national basis.
That sounds exciting. I guess that's given you opportunities to travel all over the country.
It sure is. It gives me a lot of opportunity. I just got back from Minneapolis, where we just hosted our tournament in May, and our next tournament is going to be in Reno, Nevada in 2012, and we're working on 13 and 14 right now.
Well, Sharon, it's been a pleasure to have you with us today. Is there anything you'd like to add?
I think that the best thing to add is that, you know, sometimes it's really difficult to find a job, and you get a lot of turned down mail, and a lot of people don't want to give you the opportunity. But the best thing to offer is just keep trying, because you just never know when you might get that opportunity to do something. One time I did apply for the job with Sheraton many, many years ago, and it took a whole year for them to actually contact me to ask me to come to work for them. So even though someone says no, you just got to keep trying. And one of these days, that opportunity will come.
Thank you, Sharon. It's been a pleasure to meet you and have you with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's time again for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with another episode of
Blind Justice,
featuring Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, and Abby Lewis. The scene opens outside the retirement home as Abby and her dad come to pick up Grandpa Bill.
There's Grandpa waiting. Abby, go help him into the car.
Okay, Dad. Hey, Grandpa, we're here. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let me help you into the car.
Do you remember how to do it?
I've been practicing. Okay, take my arm. Now I'm stepping off the curb, and here's the car just in front of you. Reach straight out, and you can touch the back door handle. Now you can open it for yourself.
Are you going to make me ride in the back seat?
You don't want to?
Every time I ride in the back seat, I have to sit next to my granddaughter.
You don't want to?
Of course I do. You forgot to give me a hug.
Oh, Grandpa, I forget. Hugs unlock the car doors. Now you can get in.
And why don't you open the door for me?
Because if I did, you might not know where it is and smack your nose on the door.
And what happens if I smack my nose?
You won't smell so good.
You like that joke, don't you?
Yep. Every time I tell someone at school about how to open a car door, I tell that joke.
Okay, guys, get buckled.
But that's important, Dad. The joke helps kids remember why I don't open the door for Grandpa. Then, if he ever comes to school and I'm not there, other kids would know how to open the door for him.
And that would certainly keep me smelling better.
Hey, guys, enough of the smell jokes. Dad, how you feeling today?
Since my nose isn't bent over.
Oh, Grandpa.
I'm feeling great. What are we going to do today?
We're going on a picnic. And do you know why?
No. Tell me why.
Because yesterday was the last day of school.
I'd think you'd be home doing homework.
Why?
So you wouldn't forget how.
But that's exactly what I do want. To forget how. Now, the basket is on the seat between us. Mom helped pack it. But I made the sandwiches. Guess what kind of sandwiches I made?
Peanut butter and jelly.
How did you guess?
I've got peanut butter on my coat from when you hugged me.
Abby, didn't you wash your hands?
Richard, don't forget some of your younger days. I seem to remember peanut butter on the banister and someone sliding down.
Did Dad do that?
Let's just forget about that. All right?
My lips are sealed. With peanut butter.
Why don't you two play a game? How about alphabets? There's Avenue. I got an A.
And there's another Avenue. A. And a bus. B. And a car. C. Come on, Grandpa, catch up.
Okay. I see an albatross. I see a buffalo.
There's no albatross. Or buffalo.
Dad, Grandpa sees things differently than we do. It's all right. That's the way we play. And I've got a dog, D, I mean an E. And an X for X-ray at the hospital sign. And a yellow for yellow stripes on the road. Come on, Grandpa. I only need one more, and you're an X.
I see. Axolotl.
You saw one of those once before. What are they?
They're kind of a stork-looking bat that crawls around, flying.
Come on, Grandpa. I looked it up in the dictionary and couldn't find it.
Well, it's a South American salamander. And most of the time, it's spelled with an A.
But you use it with an X.
That's because by the time I get to the X, the thing is moving so fast, I can't see the A.
Dad, she takes these things to school.
Well, the school should learn about axolotls.
Or exolotls, if they're moving fast.
And they do move fast.
And I have to go to school and explain these to the teacher.
I explained about the peanut butter in the banister.
Okay, okay. Here we are at the picnic site.
Grandpa, when I get home, I'm going to draw a picture of an axolotl for you.
That means I'll have to search out the critter so you can see what it looks like.
No, Dad. Grandpa doesn't like pictures like that. I'll put the salamander inside of a box. Then any time Grandpa wants to look at him, he lifts the lid and peeks in.
And it will be perfect.
And if you want him to run fast?
I'll peek in the other end of the box.
Okay, all out.
A picnic. What a way to celebrate.
Blind Justice.
It's time for Insights with Dr. Bill.
Hey, Dr. Bill's here.
This is Dr. Bill. Tell me what's on your mind.
Dr. Bill, we were talking earlier about an ancient Celtic language that was actually used to communicate with the blind. And that was back in the 7th century. Do you think it was something like that that happened to Helen Keller with the help of Anne Sullivan?
Well, Bob, I'm certain that some type of communication, just like what you shared from the Celtic, certainly did take place with young Helen Keller. And the portrayal in the movie with Anne Sullivan was certainly impressive, but it didn't take until she was as old as the movie suggested.
It didn't?
Remember, Helen was not born blind. That happened when she was stricken with an illness, possibly scarlet fever, when she was 19 months old.
And she started sensing things back then?
One of our volunteers, Para Tolleson, knows some things about Helen Keller, so I asked her to share some of them. Some of the things you may not know.
Thank you, Dr. Bill. Well, Bob, what I was going to tell you now comes from Helen Keller's own words. She wrote these in her own book, The Story of My Life. I cannot recall what happened during the first months after my illness. I only know that I sat in my mother's lap or clung to her dress as she went about her household duties. My hands felt every object and observed every motion, and in this way I learned to know many things. Soon I felt the need of some communication with others and began to make crude signs. A shake of my head meant no, and a nod, yes. A pull meant come, and a push meant go. Was it bread that I wanted? Then I would imitate the acts of cutting the slices and buttering them. If I wanted my mother to make ice cream for dinner, I made the sign for working the freezer and shivered, indicating cold. My mother, moreover, succeeded in making me understand a good deal. I always knew when she wished me to bring her something, and I would run upstairs or anywhere else she indicated. Indeed, I owe to her loving wisdom all that was bright and good in my long night. I understand a good deal of what was going on about me. At 5, I learned to fold and put away the clean clothes when they were brought in from the laundry, and I distinguished my own from the rest. I do not remember when I first realized I was different from other people, but I knew it before my teacher came to me. I had noticed that my mother and my friends did not use signs as I did when they wanted anything done but talk with their mouths. Sometimes I stood between two persons who were conversing and touched their lips. I could not understand, and I was vexed.
Wow. She knew she was different, but she learned an awful lot from her mother. Was there anyone else she could talk to?
As a matter of fact, this is also from her life story. In those days, the little colored girl, Martha Washington, the child of the cook, and Belle, an old setter, were my constant companions. Martha Washington understood my signs, and I seldom had any difficulty in making her do just as I wished. We spent a great deal of time in the kitchen, kneading dough balls, helping make ice cream, grinding coffee, quarreling over cake bowl, and feeding the hens and turkeys that swarmed about the kitchen steps. Many of them were so tame they would eat from my hand and let me feed them. Two little children, one as black as ebony, the other white. One child was 6 years old, and the other two or three years older. The younger child was blind, that was I, and the other was Martha Washington. So you see, long before Ann Sullivan came to be her teacher, Helen Keller was able to communicate and understand concepts of things that she gained through touch.
Wow, just like from the 7th century.
Maybe it wasn't directly from the Celtic language, but the ability to communicate was there through touch.
Para's insight into Helen Keller sure helped.
Did it?
It sure did. Thank you, Para. She sure is a smart lady.
She has to be. She's a volunteer with the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
And that comment is not limited to a print and visually impaired audience.
Dr. Bill, before we leave Helen Keller, do you know anything of her feelings later in life?
Yes, I do. Helen Keller says she did sense emptiness in her life until she found a personal comfort with an association with what was called the New Church, an outgrowth of the teachings of Emanuel Swedenborg. And we are lucky enough to have a local lady who has a rather special interest in this part of Helen Keller's life. Her name is Carolyn Leith. Welcome, Mrs. Leith.
Thank you, Dr. Bill.
Tell us a little about this interest of yours in this time of Helen Keller's life.
Well, my grandfather, Reverend Paul Sperry, was one of the ministers of the Swedenborgian Church of North America. His church was in Washington, D.C., and he was instrumental in convincing Helen Keller to write a book about her religious feelings connected with the new church. She did this in a book published in 1926 entitled My Religion. This book was reissued some years later with the title Light Unto My Feet, and I'm fortunate to have much of the correspondence that took place between Miss Keller and my grandfather.
Would you share some?
My pleasure. From her book, My Religion, for nearly 6 years I had no concepts whatever of nature or mind or death or God. I literally thought with my body. Without a single exception, my memories of that time are tactual. For 30 years I have examined and re-examined that phase of my development in the light of new theories, and I am convinced of the correctness of what I am saying. I know I was impelled like an animal to seek food and warmth. I remember crying, but not the grief that caused the tears. I kicked, and because I recall it physically, I know I was angry. I imitated those about me when I made signs for things I wanted to eat or helped to find eggs in my mother's farmyard. But there is not one spark of emotion or rational thought in these distinct yet corporal memories. I was like an unconscious clod of earth. Then suddenly, I knew not how or where or when, my brain felt the impact of another mind, and I awoke to language, to knowledge, to love, to the usual concepts of nature, of good and evil. I was actually lifted from nothingness to human life.
And now from her personal letters.
In these passages from the letters, she's reflecting on the difference the teachings of Swedenborg made in her life. And this is dated March 22, 1919. Dear Mr. Sperry, I telegraphed you this morning that I would speak at the convention of the New Jerusalem Church. I think Swedenborg's message of comfort is most appropriate at this time. It has strengthened me often during these years of war and suffering. only the vitalizing certainty that an invisible heaven encompasses us has had potency to heal my hurt spirit in a world where the walls of faith appeared to crumble and the sun of love seemed to hide its face in a tempest of hate and tears. Will you kindly convey my warm thanks to the committee for the privilege they are giving me to bear witness to the precious truths that Swedenborg revealed to us, truths which console and inspire us with fresh energy to work for a new heaven upon earth where peace shall dwell because all men have learned to love their neighbor as themselves. And another letter from January 10th, 1921. Dear Mr. Sperry, I was glad to receive the book you so thoughtfully sent, and I thank you for your kindness. It will be useful to me when I try to tell others about the new church doctrines that have made my darkness so radiant. What a small book it is, yet what a new world it will open to those who long for a higher faith and a fuller life. How it braces my spirit to know that the divine light is penetrating more and more the terrible darkness in which humanity gropes and stumbles. It may be long coming, but at last the sun shall flash forth benign, triumphant, banishing the night that killed the life in young hearts, the night that starved the souls of men.
That certainly does give us a very personal view into her life. And what a sense of loneliness that did exist without that touch of assurance. Thank you, Carolyn.
And thank you for listening to a small portion of the many letters that I have from Helen Keller to my grandfather.
I hope that helped, Bob.
From the 7th century to the present, in spite of all the changes that have occurred, not so much really has changed, has it?
And so ends another episode of Insights with Dr. Bill. Conversations. The voices of TRRS.
Today we visit with Kurt Benrud. Kurt, thank you for being with us today.
Okay, well, it's always fun to get together with you and do a little recording and a little broadcasting.
Well, thank you. Now, can you start out for our listeners and tell us a little about yourself?
Well, let me see. I was born in Minnesota, spent some time in South Dakota, spent some time in West Africa, and I've been in the Raleigh, North Carolina area for longer than the average person's been alive. But I moved here when I was 15, and I'm 59 nowadays. I went to Cary High School, went to NC State for both my bachelor's and my master's degree, and that makes me qualified to run a small fast food restaurant.
Oh, tell us about that restaurant.
Well, we serve burgers and hot dogs, milkshakes, lots of different kinds of ice cream products, french fries and onion rings, and, we try to do our best all the time, get tired out. That's about all I need to tell you, I think.
Your involvement with TRS, how did you become involved?
Well, I got a phone call one day from a fella named Ed Funkhauser, a professor over at NC State. He and another fella named Dan Bartley, they were starting up something that was going to be called the Radio Reading Service, and they had a few volunteers already, and he'd been over to the Library for the Blind, and he'd asked them, how can I find some people to be volunteer readers for this new service? And they said, well, here's the list of the people who weren't good enough for us, so try them. And my name was on the list.
How many years have you been involved now?
Well, that was about 27 years ago, and I did it 6 or 8 years to start with, and then I kind of took a hiatus when I found myself working a little harder on work, and I wasn't able to commit like I had been. And then at one point, I just said, you know what, it's time to come back. So, out of that 27 years, I'd guess I was been at it for at least 18 or 19 of them.
What kind of broadcasting do you hear?
My mainstay has always been the news in the evening. I've been doing the second and fourth Tuesday since before the turn of the century, And I've worn out a few partners already. But sometime back there in the neighborhood of the turn of the century, I started doing a show called Movie Reviews and Theater Previews, which publicized plays, movies, everything that's available with audio description. And I did that up until about 4 or 5 months ago when I asked my good friend Ramona Trainer to take it over. And Ramona is showing me how it's supposed to be done now.
And what are you involved with now?
Well, I'm still on the business about audio description because I really like theater, I really like literature, and I really like making it as inclusive as possible. Anytime a local theater is producing a play with an audio-described performance that's based on a novel, I try to get the novel read on the air enough in advance so that any listeners that may want to attend the play will have had the opportunity to have read the novel. I also stay in touch with the theaters to make sure that any of them that wish to offer free tickets for users of the audio description can know that there's a way to make this information happen. I've started some conversation with the local movie theaters. That would be the North Hills Stadium, the Beaver Creek in Apex, and the White Oak in Garner. Been in contact with their powers that be to see about getting some free passes to the movies in order to encourage some of our listeners to go take advantage of the fact that almost all the time there is at least one movie playing in the area that has audio description, and you can go with your friends and family to the movies and you can enjoy the experience. Another thing, they asked me last fall if I could do a Thanksgiving show, so I recruited a few friends of mine. We came in, did a 30-minute Thanksgiving show, and then I got this cute idea, ask friends of mine who wants to read a Christmas story. And the next thing I knew, I was putting together 15 hours worth of programming for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I've got in the makings, there is a novel that I'd hoped to have ready for back around this Thanksgiving, but it's been shelved. But we're going to have it ready for next Thanksgiving. It's a book about a dysfunctional family that has a very dysfunctional Thanksgiving day. And we're going to try to time it so that it's broadcast so that the Thanksgiving episode happens during Thanksgiving week. Got the people that were in the play I was in the fall, Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. We are still planning on recording that for a serial broadcast. I've got in the back of my mind something called the Shakespeare Hour, where you get a piece of the play and you have to listen to me talk about it as though I were an English teacher, because that's what I also am in my other lifetime. And finally, really as soon as Bob and I are done with this interview today, I've got some people coming in to record a locally written, locally produced 10-minute play, and I will be starting a 30-minute show once or twice a month that will be local plays adapted to radio.
Well, it sounds like you are very committed to this audio description.
I am.
Just in case we have some listeners that aren't totally familiar with that, could you give us a brief description of what actually is audio description?
Well, audio description is it makes it so that your ears can see what's on the stage or on the screen. There's a soundtrack goes with every movie. There's dialogue in every play. There are sound effects. And there are people that have been trained to be audio describers who immerse themselves in the particular work, the play, the movie, whatever, and make it so that they can lay description of the visuals between the lines and between the sound effects. So you get to hear everything that the rest of the audience hears. Plus, you get to hear description of the action. You get to hear description of what the set looks like, where the furniture is. Frequently, the theaters start audio description 30 minutes before the show starts. And so if you take your seat, you get a pretty thorough description of what the set looks like. Some theaters actually offer a tactile tour beforehand, so that anybody wishing to can go up on the stage and they'll move you around and show you, lay your hands on each piece of furniture, where everything is. And a few of the theaters also offer Braille programs and large print programs. The Governor Moorhead School has given us the opportunity to make Braille programs available for shows that I'm involved in. I simply have to send them an electronic copy of the text. They print it on the Braille printer. I tell them how many copies we need. I've got five takers, so I'm going to have them print five Braille programs.
Kurt, thank you for being with us today. Before you go, do you have any last thoughts?
Well, I think the most important thing I want to talk about is the upcoming show being done with the local actors doing locally written plays. It'll be a 30-minute show. Most of the time it'll be two plays, each one under 15 minutes, cobbled together with a little music ahead, a little music in between, a little music at the end. Listen in for the announcements for when it's coming up, and please be prepared to let us know if you enjoy it, because if you do, we're going to do more.
Thank you, Kurt.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Have a good day.
It's time for the TRRS Radio Theater on the Air with another episode of Blind Justice with Bill McClure, Richard Dunnigan, Bob Martin, and Abby Lewis. The scene opens following last week's story with Bill and his son and granddaughter arriving at the picnic area.
That looks like a good spot under the tree. Abby, take the blanket and Grandpa over under the tree, and I'll bring the basket.
Take my arm, Grandpa. Just think, school's out and we're having a picnic. No more papers, no more books, no more teachers' dirty looks, yeah!
I'll give you a dirty look, if it'll make you feel better.
You haven't got a dirty look, Grandpa. You'll have to do better than that.
Here's the picnic basket. You two go ahead and start. I have to go back to the car for a few minutes. I brought my laptop and have to finish up a couple of things.
Don't expect us to save the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for you.
Dad's got a very important job and has a lot of homework. Mom says so. I'm glad you don't have to do that.
I have a more important job now.
What's that?
Eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
You're good at that job, Grandpa. I think your shirt is good at it, too. Here's a napkin.
I think it's time for another game. And this time, I choose.
Okay, what do we do?
Lean back and close your eyes.
Will you close your eyes, too?
If you want me to.
No, I know you won't cheat. Now what?
Listen to that bird. Can you tell me what kind it is?
That one's easy. That's a woodpecker.
Okay. How about that one?
I don't know that one.
That's a cardinal. And this one?
I can guess that one. It's a crow.
And one more.
No. What's that?
That's a sparrow.
And can you tell what kind of bird it is without being able to see it?
Right. Now, can you hear a cricket?
They chirp by rubbing their legs together, right?
A lot of people believe that, but that's not true. They have something that looks like little teeth on the bottom of one wing, and they chirp by rubbing one wing against the other.
I hear one, Grandpa.
You know something else? That chirp came from a male cricket.
How can you tell the difference?
It takes years of practice. You have to do a lot of listening.
Do you think I'll ever be able to tell the difference?
Actually, you can do it right now. Only male crickets can chirp.
Are there any other animals like that?
How about the ducks down by the pond?
I know what a duck sounds like.
But did you know you can tell a boy duck from a girl duck by listening to them?
No way. What's the difference?
Well, boy ducks have a low kind of quack, sort of like this.
Quack, 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 quack.
And girl ducks are higher and faster, sort of like
quack, 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 quack.
That's funny, Grandpa.
You listen the next time you're down by the pond. It won't take long, and you'll be a quack expert. Just take a saltine with you to make them talk.
Why will that help?
Ducks like quackers.
Grandpa, that's awful.
Thank you.
Hey, you two. Is anything left? I'm hungry.
Did you hear that?
Yes.
What do you think?
Male.
Yes, male.
But are you absolutely sure?
Maybe we'd better double check.
Do you think we ought to?
Absolutely.
Okay, you do it.
No, you do it.
No, you.
It was your idea.
Okay. Hey, Dad, do you want some peanut butter? It's on a quacker.
A quacker? What are you two talking about?
Definitely male.
Absolutely.
Another picnic successfully concluded with... Blind Justice. And now another remembrance of childhood at Governor Moorhead School from Myra DeBruhl.
This little story is called The Easter Bonnet, and it happened while I'm still in K Cottage, still not getting to pick out my own clothes and wear what I want to. But I really got to one time. It was going to be an Easter program, and Billy Davis, my friend, and I, we were going to sing Me in My Easter Bonnet and He in Your Easter Bonnet, and we were going to promenade around the stage like really grown-up people. And at the end of that song, Billy was supposed to kiss me on the cheek. And I got to wear my white Dotted Swiss dress. Dotted Swiss was big in those days. And it had a red sash around it with a bow. And my hat had a red sash around it with a bow. And I remember saying to Miss Johnson, "Can I wear my hair in a ponytail? I don't like this hat." And she said, "Well, it wouldn't look really good to sing about your Easter bonnet and not have one on now, would it?" And I remember finally we were ready for the program almost to start. And Miss Davis walked up and she said, "Myra, that's a really pretty dress." And I said, "Well, thank you, but I'd rather be singing Peter Cottontail." And she said, "Well, now, you wouldn't want to be having to wear a furry bunny outfit, would you?" And I said, "Well, then Billy wouldn't have to kiss me." And she turned around to Billy and said, "You don't mind kissing her, do you, Billy?" And he said, "I'd rather kiss a bunny." Well, about that time, one of the older boys, high school boys, Bobby Churchill, he came by, and he picked me up and swung me around and kissed my cheek. And I said, "Can Bobby kiss me instead, Miss Davis?" Miss Davis took us by the shoulders, and she said, "Now, this program starts in 15 minutes. Myra, you will not sing Peter Cottontail. And Billy, you will kiss her cheek. Is that understood?" Well, you know, as I look back on it now, I think that must have been adorable, these little 8-year-old kids promenading around the stage singing, "In my Easter bonnet, with all the frills upon it, I'll be the grandest lady in the Easter parade." At the end of the song, when Billy kissed my cheek, I didn't stick out my tongue like I planned to. Instead, I kissed him back. Miss Davis hugged us when we went backstage, and then the fourth graders came up to sing Peter Cottontail.
How about bringing in Professor Bill?
Good idea. It's time now for Outside the Box with Professor Bill. The problem. A man had worked for the railroad all his life, and when he retired, he was all but lost. Railroad was all he knew. So he bought an old caboose and found a discarded siding about half a mile from the tracks, and there he lived. But once in a while, sometimes in the middle of the day, sometimes in the middle of the night, the lonesomeness would get to him. The only way to relax was to go down to the tracks and wait until a train came by. He could smell the smells, feel the rush of wind, and hear the whistle. After the train passed, he could return back to his caboose and rest. While he was waiting, he started counting the trains and discovered that 3 out of every 4 trains were heading west. Only 1 out of 4 were heading east. How could this be? One day he got a hold of the station master and asked him to explain what he saw. The station master assured him that the same number of trains went one way as the other. Can you explain his predicament?
Well, the same number has to be going one way as the other, or else all the trains would end up at one side of the country.
True.
So, the guy just isn't counting correctly.
The fellow is accurate. He does see 3 times as many trains going west as going east.
Then the station master is wrong.
No, the station master is also correct. The same number of trains go one way as the other.
Then some trains are sneaking around behind him. Trains can be sneaky.
The answer here is simple. He doesn't go down to the tracks at the same time.
Whenever he's nervous, he goes and then waits for the next train to pass by.
Well, how does that help?
If you were to take a look at the train schedule, you would find that trains going west pass by his location at 15 minutes before the hour, and the trains traveling east pass by exactly on the hour.
I see. Since he goes down at any old time, he only has 15 minutes between quarter till and the hour to see an eastbound train. But there could be 45 minutes to wait for the westbound train.
Think random time. He is three times more likely to see a train going west.
It's all so simple when you see the answer.
It is for me.
Another solution, thanks to creative thinking from... Outside the Box. Let's end today's program with our poem and song.
We raced across the schoolyard so many years ago. Impossible all by myself, changes I could not know. So you held out your arm, then crossed the fields we'd run. We did it neath the moon and stars, likewise a warming sun. Oh, we had our share of trips and bumps, but never did they harm, since it was you who'd choose the course, and I would choose your arm. Then came city traffic lights, yellow, red, and green. Away we'd go through all the snarls and the troubles left unseen. Cars would stop. Cars would go, traveling by so fast, before we knew their coming, we realized they'd passed. Forget the honks. Ignore the yells. Their noise caused no alarm, since you were there beside me, and I held on to your arm. A date. A dance. Oh, should I go? Which way am I to turn? There seems so much for me to know. How simple it was to learn. I took your arm, and you took mine. Across the floor we'd glide, sometimes fast and sometimes slow, but always side by side. How easy it was! And then to find such fun, such joy, a charm-filled life when you reach out and touch a waiting arm. Then graduation. I was so proud, I heard them call my name. I strode up to the platform. Onto that stage I came. Not a smile did I see that day, but I felt them all the same. A briefest silence followed. Then again, they spoke my name. I had done it, yes, but not alone. Beside, I felt you warm. One hand grasped my diploma, the other caressed your arm. Then one day, quite unexpectedly, she came into my life. When she offered me her elbow, a house, a home, a wife. What to do? Where to go? What would the future hold? Would we be able to survive? Her arm, the stories told. Through grocery trips and bills to pay, tended furnaces to keep us warm. What a joy it's been through all these years to reach out and take your arm. Oh, through the years were many friends who've spent some time with me. And from that arm that I could feel, there was care that I could see. We've shared business and pleasure. We've shared joy and also care. You didn't even have to speak. I knew that you were there. I dared go on each and every day, a future without alarm, because you were there beside me and offered me your arm.
This story is not ended here. One more voice before we go. And you must hear it now, if the truth you wish to know. I am one of many friends whose arm was there to touch, to cross a street, to climb a stair, to talk to, and the such. And it may not be seen by those who saw the many open doors, though there were times you held my arm, so many more when I needed yours.
You You see beauty in the fragrance of the flowers when they bloom. You see brightness in the sunshine as it warms your face in June. You hear laughter in the children, and you see their beaming smiles. You see friendship when you talk with me a while. You can see the good in people when I only see skin deep. You see the need that's often hidden in the people that you meet. Just because I view the world with such different eyes than you, does it mean that I can see more than you do? Would you help me to see the world like you? Take my arm, walk with me, and together we can see. I need you, and you need me. Take my arm, take my arm, stand and together we will see how the world was meant to be. Take my arm, take my arm.